lighted up below by jets of gas, and further away rose the huge dark mass of St. Isaac's, hardly distinguishable against the gloomy sky.
"You used to say, Vanya, that he was a nice man, good and generous, with feeling, with a heart. Well, you see, they're all like that, your nice people, your men with heart. All they can do is to beget orphans. And I should think he must have felt cheerful at dying like that. Ech, anything to get away from here. Even Siberia. What is it, child?"
he asked suddenly, seeing a little girl on the pavement begging alms. It was a pale, thin child, not more than 7 or 8, dressed in filthy rags. She had broken shoes on her little bare feet. She was trying to cover her shivering little body with a sort of aged semblance of a tiny dress, long outgrown. Her pale, sickly, wasted face was turned towards us. She looked timidly, mutely at us, without speaking, and with a look of resigned dread of refusal held out her trembling little hand to us. My old friend started at seeing her, and turned to her so quickly that he frightened her. She was startled and stepped back.
"What is it? What is it, child?"
he cried.
"You're begging, eh? Here's something for you. Take it."
And shaking with fuss and excitement, he began feeling in his pocket, and brought out 2 or 3 silver coins. But it seemed to him too little. He found his purse, and taking out a ruble note, all that was in it, put it in the little beggar's hand.
"Christ keep you, my little one, my child. God's angel be with you."
And with a trembling hand he made the sign of the cross over the child several times. But suddenly noticing that I was looking at him, he frowned and walked on with rapid steps.
"That's the thing I can't bear to see, Vanya,"
he began, after a rather prolonged, wrathful silence.
"Little innocent creatures shivering with cold in the street. All through their cursed fathers and mothers. Though what mother would send a child to anything so awful if she were not in misery herself? Most likely she has other helpless little ones in the corner at home, and this is the oldest of them, and the mother ill herself, very likely. And, they're not princes' children. There are lots in the world, Vanya, not princes' children.
He paused for a moment, as though at a loss for words.
"You see, Vanya, I promised Anna Andreevna,"
he began, faltering and hesitating a little.
"I promised her, that is, Anna Andreevna and I agreed together to take some little orphan to bring up, some poor little girl, to have her in the house altogether, do you understand? For it's dull for us old people alone. Only, you see, Anna Andreevna has begun to set herself against it somehow. So you talk to her, you know, not from me, but as though it came from yourself. Persuade her, you understand? I've been meaning for a long time to ask you to persuade her to agree. You see, it's rather awkward for me to press her. But why talk about trifles? What's a child to me? I don't want one, perhaps just as a comfort, so as to hear a child's voice. But the fact is, I'm doing this for my wife's sake. It'll be livelier for her than being alone with me. But all that's nonsense. Vanya, we shall be a long time getting there like this, you know. Let's take a cab. It's a long walk, and Anna Andreevna will have been expecting us."
It was 7:30 when we arrived. Chapter 12. The Ichmenyevs were very fond of each other. They were closely united by love and years of habit. Yet Nikolai Sergeyitch was not only now, but had even in former days, in their happiest times, always been rather reserved with his Anna Andreevna, sometimes even surly, especially before other people. Some delicate and sensitive natures show a peculiar perversity, a sort of chaste dislike of expressing themselves, and expressing their tenderness, even to the being dearest to them, not only before people, but also in private. Even more in private, in fact. Only at rare intervals their affection breaks out, and it breaks out more passionately and more impulsively the longer it has been restrained. This was rather how Ichmenyev had been with his Anna Andreevna from their youth upwards. He loved and respected her beyond measure, in spite of the fact that she was only a good-natured woman who was capable of nothing but loving him, and that he was sometimes positively vexed with her because, in her simplicity, she was often tactlessly open with him. But after Natasha had gone away, they somehow became tenderer to one another. They were painfully conscious of being left all alone in the world. And though Nikolai Sergeyitch was sometimes extremely gloomy, they could not be apart for 2 hours at a time without distress and uneasiness. They had made a sort of tacit compact not to say a word about Natasha, as though she had passed out of existence. Anna Andreevna did not dare to make any allusion to her in her husband's presence, though this restraint was very hard for her. She had long ago in her heart forgiven Natasha. It had somehow become an established custom that every time I came I should bring her news of her beloved and never forgotten child. The mother was quite ill if she did not get news for some time, and when I came with tidings she was interested in the smallest details, and inquired with trembling curiosity. My accounts relieved her heart. She almost died of fright once when Natasha had fallen ill, and was on the point of going to her herself. But this was an extreme case. At first she was not able to bring herself to express even to me a desire to see her daughter, and almost always after our talk, when she had extracted everything from me, she thought it needful to draw herself up before me and to declare that though she was interested in her daughter's fate, yet Natasha had behaved so wickedly that she could never be forgiven. But all this was put on. There were times when Anna Andreevna grieved hopelessly, shed tears, called Natasha by the fondest names before me, bitterly complained against Nikolai Sergeyitch, and began in his presence to drop hints, though with great circumspection, about some people's pride, about hard-heartedness, about our not being able to forgive injuries, and God's not forgiving the unforgiving. But she never went further than this in his presence. At such times her husband immediately got cross and sullen, and would sit silent and scowling, or begin suddenly talking of something else very loudly and awkwardly, or finally go off to his own room, leaving us alone, and so giving Anna Andreevna a chance to pour out her sorrows to me in tears and lamentations. He always went off to his own rooms like this when I arrived, sometimes scarcely leaving time to greet me so as to give me a chance to tell Anna Andreevna all the latest news of Natasha. He did the same thing now.
"I'm wet through," he said, as soon as he walked into the room. "I'll go to my room. And you, Vanya, stay here. Such a business he's been having with his lodgings. You tell her. I'll be back directly."
And he hurried away, trying not even to look at us, as though ashamed of having brought us together. On such occasions, and especially when he came back, he was always very curt and gloomy, both with me and Anna Andreevna, even fault-finding, as though vexed and angry with himself for his own softness and consideration.
"You see how he is,"
said Anna Andreevna, who had of late laid aside all her stiffness with me and all her mistrust of me.
"That's how he always is with me. And yet he knows we understand all his tricks. Why should he keep up a pretense with me? Am I a stranger to him? He's just the same about his daughter. He might forgive her, you know. Perhaps he even wants to forgive her. God knows, he cries at night. I've heard him. But he keeps up outwardly. He's eaten up with pride. Ivan Petrovitch, my dear, tell me quick, where was he going?"
"Nikolai Sergeyitch? I don't know. I was going to ask you."
"I was dismayed when he went out. He's ill, you know, and in such weather, and so late. I thought it must be for something important. And what can be more important than what you know of? I thought this to myself, but I didn't dare to ask. Why, I daren't question him about anything nowadays. My goodness! I was simply terror-stricken on his account, and on hers. What, thought I, if he has gone to her? What if he's made up his mind to forgive her? Why, he's found out everything. He knows the latest news of her. I feel certain he knows it. But how the news gets to him, I can't imagine. He was terribly depressed yesterday, and today, too. But why don't you say something? Tell me, my dear, what has happened? I've been longing for you like an angel of God. I've been all eyes watching for you. Come, will the villain abandon Natasha?"
I told Anna Andreevna at once all I knew. I was always completely open with her. I told her that things seemed drifting to rupture between Natasha and Alyosha, and that this was more serious than their previous misunderstandings, that Natasha had sent me a note the day before, begging me to come this evening at 9 o'clock, and so I had not intended to come and see them that evening. Nikolai Sergeyitch himself had brought me. I explained and told her minutely that the position was now altogether critical, that Alyosha's father, who had been back for a fortnight after an absence, would hear nothing and was taking Alyosha sternly in hand. But, what was most important of all, Alyosha seemed himself not disinclined to the proposed match, and it was said he was positively in love with the young lady. I added that I could not help guessing that Natasha's note was written in great agitation. She wrote that tonight everything would be decided, but what was to be decided I did not know. It was also strange that she had written yesterday but had only asked me to come this evening, and had fixed the hour 9 o'clock. And so I was bound to go, and as quickly as possible.
"Go, my dear boy, go by all means,"
Anna Andreevna urged me anxiously.
"Have just a cup of tea as soon as he comes back. Ach, they haven't brought the samovar. Matryona, why are you so long with samovar? She's a saucy baggage. Then, when you've drunk your tea, find some good excuse and get away. But be sure to come tomorrow and tell me everything, and run round early. Good heavens, something dreadful may have happened already. Though, how could things be worse than they are when you come to think of it? Why, Nikolai Sergeyitch knows everything. My heart tells me he does. I hear a great deal through Matryona, and she through Agasha, and Agasha is the goddaughter of Marya Vasilyevna, who lives in the prince's house. But there, you know all that. My Nikolai was terribly angry today. I tried to say one thing and another, and he almost shouted at me. And then he seemed sorry, said he was short of money, just as though he'd been making an outcry about money. You know our circumstances. After dinner he went to have a nap. I peeped at him through the chink, there's a chink in the door he doesn't know of, and he, poor dear, was on his knees, praying before the shrine. I felt my legs give way under me when I saw it. He didn't sleep, and he had no tea. He took up his hat and went out. He went out at 5 o'clock. I didn't dare question him. He'd have shouted at me. He's taken to shouting, generally at Matryona, but sometimes at me. And when he starts, it makes my legs go numb, and there's a sinking at my heart. Of course, it's foolishness. I know it's his foolishness, but still it frightens me. I prayed for a whole hour after he went out that God would send him some good thought. Where is her note? Show it me.
I showed it. I knew that Anna Andreevna cherished a secret dream that Alyosha, whom she called at one time a villain and at another a stupid, heartless boy, would in the end marry Natasha, and that the prince, his father, would consent to it. She even let this out to me, though at other times she regretted it and went back on her words. But nothing would have made her venture to betray her hopes before Nikolai Sergeyitch, though she knew her husband suspected them, and even indirectly reproached her for them more than once. I believe that he would have cursed Natasha and shut her out of his heart forever if he had known of the possibility of such a marriage. We all thought so at the time. He longed for his daughter with every fibre of his being, but he longed for her alone, with every memory of Alyosha cast out of her heart. It was the one condition of forgiveness, and though it was not uttered in words, it could be understood, and could not be doubted when one looked at him.
"He's a silly boy with no backbone, no backbone, and he's cruel. I always said so,"
Anna Andreevna began again.
"And they didn't know how to bring him up, so he's turned out a regular weathercock. He's abandoning her after all her love. What will become of her poor child? And what can he have found in this new girl, I should like to know?"
"I have heard, Anna Andreevna," I replied, "that his proposed fiancée is a delightful girl. Yes, and Natalia Nikolaevna says the same thing about her."
"Don't you believe it?"
the mother interrupted.
"Delightful indeed. You scribblers think everyone's delightful if only she wears petticoats. As for Natasha's speaking well of her, she does that in the generosity of her heart. She doesn't know how to control him. She forgives him everything, but she suffers herself. How often he has deceived her already. The cruel-hearted villains! I'm simply terrified, Ivan Petrovitch. They're all demented with pride. If my good man would only humble himself, if he would forgive my poor darling and fetch her home. If only I could hug her, if I could look at her. Has she got thinner?"
"She has got thin, Anna Andreevna."
"My darling, I'm in terrible trouble, Ivan Petrovitch. All last night and all today I've been crying. But there, I'll tell you about it afterwards. How many times I began hinting to him to forgive her. I daren't say it right out, so I begin to hint at it, in a tactful way. And my heart's in a flutter all the time. I keep expecting him to get angry and curse her once for all. I haven't heard a curse from him yet. Well, that's what I'm afraid of, that he'll put his curse upon her. And what will happen then? God's punishment falls on the child the father has cursed. So I'm trembling with terror every day. And you ought to be ashamed too, Ivan Petrovitch, to think you've grown up in our family, and been treated like a son by both of us, and yet you can speak of her being delightful too. But there Marya Vasilyevna knows better. I may have done wrong, but I asked her in to coffee one day, when my good man had gone out for the whole morning. She's told me all the ins and outs of it. The prince, Alyosha's father, is in shocking relations with his countess. They say the countess keeps reproaching him with not marrying her, but he keeps putting it off. This fine countess was talked about for her shameless behavior while her husband was living. When her husband died, she went abroad. She used to have all sorts of Italians and Frenchmen about her, and barons of some sort. It was there she caught Prince Pyotr Alexandrovitch. And meantime, her stepdaughter, the child of her first husband, the spirit contractor, has been growing up. This countess, the stepmother, has spent all she had, but the stepdaughter has been growing up, and the 2 millions her father had left invested for her have been growing too. Now they say she has 3 millions. The prince has got wind of it, so he's keen on the match for Alyosha. He's a sharp fellow. He won't let a chance slip. The count, their relative, who's a great gentleman at court, you remember, has given his approval too. A fortune of 3 millions is worth considering. Excellent, he said. Talk it over with the countess. So the prince told the countess of his wishes. She opposed it tooth and nail. She's an unprincipled woman, a regular termagant, they say. They say some people won't receive her here. It's very different from abroad. No, she says, you marry me, prince, instead of my stepdaughter's marrying Alyosha. And the girl, they say, gives way to her stepmother in everything. She almost worships her and always obeys her. She's a gentle creature, they say, a perfect angel. The prince sees how it is and tells the countess not to worry herself. You've spent all your money, says he, and your debts you can never pay. But as soon as your stepdaughter marries Alyosha, there'll be a pair of them. You're innocent and my little fool. We'll take them under our wing and be their guardians together. Then you'll have plenty of money. What's the good of your marrying me? He's a sharp fellow, a regular mason. 6 months ago the countess wouldn't make up her mind to it, but since then, they say, they've been staying at Warsaw, and there they've come to an agreement. That's what I've heard. All this Maria Vasilievna told me from beginning to end. She heard it all on good authority. So you see, it's all a question of money and millions, and not her being delightful.
Anna Andreevna's story impressed me. It fitted in exactly with all I had heard myself from Alyosha. When he talked of it, he had stoutly declared that he would never marry for money. But he had been struck and attracted by Katerina Fyodorovna. I had heard from Alyosha, too, that his father was contemplating marriage, though he denied all rumor of it to avoid irritating the countess prematurely. I have mentioned already that Alyosha was very fond of his father, admired him and praised him, and believed in him as though he were an oracle.
She's not of a count's family, you know, the girl you call delightful,
Anna Andreevna went on, deeply resenting my praise of the young prince's future fiancé.
Why, Natasha would be a better match for him. She's a spirit dealer's daughter, while Natasha is a well-born girl of a good old family. Yesterday, I forgot to tell you, my old man opened his box, you know, the wrought-iron one. He sat opposite me the whole evening, sorting out our old family papers. And he sat so solemnly over it. I was knitting a stocking, and I didn't look at him. I was afraid to. When he saw I didn't say a word, he got cross, and called me himself, and he spent the whole evening telling me about our pedigree. And do you know, it seems that the Ichmenyevs were noblemen in the days of Ivan the Terrible, and that my family, the Shumilovs, were well known even in the days of Tsar Alexei Mihailovich. We've the documents to prove it, and it's mentioned in Karamzin's history, too. So you see, my dear boy, we're as good as other people on that side. As soon as my old man began talking to me, I saw what was in his mind. It was clear he felt bitterly Natasha's being slighted. It's only through their wealth they're set above us. That robber, Pyotr Alexandrovitch, may well make a fuss about money. Everyone knows he's a cold-hearted, greedy soul. They say he joined the Jesuits in secret when he was in Warsaw. Is it true?
It's a stupid rumor, I answered, though I could not help being struck by the persistence of this rumor. But what she had told me of her husband's going over his family records was interesting. He had never boasted of his pedigree before.
It's all the cruel-hearted villains,
Anna Andreevna went on.
Well, tell me about my darling. Is she grieving and crying? Oh, it's time you went to her. Matryona, she's a saucy baggage. Have they insulted her? Tell me, Vanya.
What could I answer her? The poor lady was in tears. I asked her what was the fresh trouble of which she had been about to tell me just now.
Ah, my dear boy, as though we hadn't trouble enough. It seems our cup was not full enough. You remember, my dear, or perhaps you don't remember, I had a little locket set in gold, a keepsake, and in it a portrait of Natasha as a child. She was 8 years old then, my little angel. We ordered it from a travelling artist at the time, but I see you've forgotten. He was a good artist. He painted her as a cupid. She'd such fair hair in those days, all fluffy. He painted her in a little muslin smock, so that her little body shows through, and she looked so pretty in it you couldn't take your eyes off her. I begged the artist to put little wings on her, but he wouldn't agree. Well, after all our dreadful troubles, I took it out of its case and hung it on a string round my neck. So I've been wearing it beside my cross, though I was afraid he might see it. You know, he told me at the time to get rid of all her things out of the house, or burn them, so that nothing might remind us of her. But I must have her portrait to look at anyway. Sometimes I cry looking at it, and it does me good. And another time, when I'm alone, I keep kissing it as though I were kissing her herself. I call her fond names, and make the sign of the cross over it every night. I talk aloud to her when I'm alone, ask her a question, and fancy she has answered, and ask her another. Oh, Vanya, dear, it makes me sad to talk about it. Well, so I was glad he knew nothing of the locket and hadn't noticed it. But yesterday morning the locket was gone. The string hung loose. It must have worn through, and I dropped it. I was aghast. I hunted and hunted high and low. It wasn't to be found. Not a sign of it anywhere. It was lost. And where could it have dropped? I made sure I must have lost it in bed, and rummaged through everything. Nowhere. If it had come off and dropped, someone might have picked it up, and who could have found it except him or Matryona? One can't think of its being Matryona. She's devoted to me, heart and soul. Matryona, are you going to bring that samovar? I keep thinking what will happen if he's found it. I sit so sad, and keep crying and crying, and can't keep back my tears. And Nikolai Sergeyitch is kinder and kinder to me, as though he knows what I'm grieving about, and is sorry for me. Well, I've been wondering, how could he tell? Hasn't he, perhaps, really found the locket and thrown it out of the window? In anger, he's capable of it, you know. He's thrown it out, and now he's sad about it himself, and sorry he threw it out. I've been already with Matryona to look under the window. I found nothing. Every trace has vanished. I've been crying all night. It's the first night I haven't made the sign of the cross over her. Oh, it's a bad sign, Ivan Petrovitch. It's a bad sign. It's an omen of evil. For 2 days I've been crying without stopping. I've been expecting you, my dear, as an angel of God, if only to relieve my heart.
And the poor lady wept bitterly.
Oh, yes, I forgot to tell you,
she began suddenly, pleased at remembering.
Have you heard anything from him about an orphan girl?
Yes, Anna Andreevna. He told me you had both thought of it, and agreed to take a poor girl, an orphan, to bring up. Is that true?
I've never thought of it, my dear boy. I've never thought of it. I don't want any orphan girl. She'll remind me of our bitter lot, our misfortune. I want no one but Natasha. She was my only child, and she shall remain the only one. But what does it mean that he should have thought of an orphan? What do you think, Ivan Petrovitch? Is it to comfort me, do you suppose, looking at my tears, or to drive his own daughter out of his mind altogether, and attach himself to another child? What did he say about me as you came along? How did he seem to you? Morose? Angry? Psst, here he is. Afterwards, my dear, tell me afterwards. Don't forget to come tomorrow.
Chapter 13. The old man came in. He looked at us with curiosity, and as though ashamed of something, frowned and went up to the table.
Where's the samovar?
He asked.
You mean to say she couldn't bring it till now?
It's coming, my dear, it's coming. Here, she's brought it,
said Anna Andreevna fussily. Matryona appeared with a samovar as soon as she saw Nikolai Sergeyitch, as though she had been waiting to bring it till he came in. She was an old, tried and devoted servant, but the most self-willed and grumbling creature in the world, with an obstinate and stubborn character. She was afraid of Nikolai Sergeyitch and always curbed her tongue in his presence. But she made up for it with Anna Andreevna, was rude to her at every turn, and openly attempted to govern her mistress, though at the same time she had a warm and genuine affection for her and for Natasha. I had known Matryona in the old days at Ichmenyevka.
It's not pleasant when one's wet through and they won't even get one tea,
the old man muttered. Anna Andreevna at once made a sign to me. He could not endure these mysterious signals. And though at the minute he tried not to look at us, one could see from his face that Anna Andreevna had just signalled to me about him, and that he was fully aware of it.
I have been to see about my case, Vanya,
he began suddenly.
It's a wretched business. Did I tell you? It's going against me altogether. It appears I've no proofs, none of the papers I ought to have. My facts cannot be authenticated, it seems.
He was speaking of his lawsuit with the prince, which was still dragging on, but had taken a very bad turn for Nikolai Sergeyitch. I was silent, not knowing what to answer. He looked suspiciously at me.
Well,
he brought out suddenly, as though irritated by our silence.
The quicker the better. They won't make a scoundrel of me, even if they do decide I must pay. I have my conscience, so let them decide. Anyway, the case will be over. It will be settled. I shall be ruined. I'll give up everything and go to Siberia.
Good heavens! What a place to go to! And why so far?
Anna Andreevna could not resist saying.
And here, what are we near?
He asked, gruffly, as though glad of the objection.
Why, near people, anyway,
began Anna Andreevna, and she glanced at me in distress.
What sort of people?
He cried, turning his feverish eyes from me to her and back again.
What people? Robbers, slanderers, traitors. There are plenty of such people everywhere. Don't be uneasy. We shall find them in Siberia, too. If you don't want to come with me, you can stay here. I won't take you against your will.
Nikolai Sergeyitch, my dear, with whom should I stay without you? Why, I've no one but you in the hall.
She faltered, broke off, and turned to me with a look of alarm, as though begging for help and support. The old man was irritated and was ready to take offense at anything. It was impossible to contradict him. Come now, Anna Andreevna, said I. It's not half as bad in Siberia as you think. If the worst comes to the worst and you have to sell Ichmenyevka, Nikolai Sergeyitch's plan is very good, in fact. In Siberia, you might get a good private job, and then...
Well, you're talking sense, Ivan, anyway. That's just what I thought. I'll give up everything and go away.
Well, that I never did expect,
cried Anna Andreevna, flinging up her hands.
And you, too, Vanya. I didn't expect it of you. Why, you've never known anything but kindness from us, and now...
Ha! What else did you expect? Why, what are we to live upon? Consider that. Our money spent. We've come to our last farthing. Perhaps you'd like me to go to Prince Pyotr Alexandrovich and beg his pardon, eh?
Hearing the prince's name, Anna Andreevna trembled with alarm. The teaspoon in her hand tinkled against the saucer.
Yes, speaking seriously,
the old man went on, working himself up with malicious, obstinate pleasure.
What do you think, Vanya? Shouldn't I really go to him? Why go to Siberia? I'd much better comb my hair, put on my best clothes, and brush myself tomorrow. Anna Andreevna will get me a new shirt front. One can't go to see a person like that without. Buy me gloves, to be the correct thing, and then I'll go to His Excellency. Your Excellency, little father benefactor, forgive me and have pity on me. Give me a crust of bread. I've a wife and little children. Is that right, Anna Andreevna? Is that what you want?
My dear, I want nothing. I spoke without thinking. Forgive me if I vexed you. Only don't shout,
she brought out, trembling more and more violently in her terror. I am convinced that everything was topsy-turvy and aching in his heart at that moment, as he looked at his poor wife's tears in alarm. I am sure that he was suffering far more than she was, but he could not control himself. So it is sometimes with the most good-natured people of weak nerves, who in spite of their kindliness are carried away till they find enjoyment in their own grief and anger, and try to express themselves at any cost, even that of wounding some other innocent creature, always by preference the one nearest and dearest. A woman sometimes has a craving to feel unhappy and aggrieved, though she has no misfortune or grievance. There are many men like women in this respect, and men, indeed, by no means feeble, and who have very little that is feminine about them. The old man had a compelling impulse to quarrel, though he was made miserable by it himself. I remember that the thought dawned on me at the time, hadn't he perhaps really before this gone out on some project such as Anna Andreevna suspected? What if God had softened his heart and he had really been going to Natasha and had changed his mind on the way, or something had gone wrong and made him give up his intentions, as was sure to happen? And so he had returned home angry and humiliated, ashamed of his recent feelings and wishes, looking out for someone on whom to vent his anger for his weakness, and pitching on the very ones whom he suspected of sharing the same feeling and wishes. Perhaps, when he wanted to forgive his daughter, he pictured the joy and rapture of his poor Anna Andreevna, and when it came to nothing, she was, of course, the first to suffer for it. But her look of hopelessness, as she trembled with fear before him, touched him. He seemed ashamed of his wrath, and for a minute controlled himself. We were all silent. I was trying not to look at him, but the good moment did not last long. At all costs, he must express himself by some outburst, or a curse if need be.
You see, Vanya,
he said suddenly,
I'm sorry. I didn't want to speak, but the time has come when I must speak out openly, without evasion, as every straightforward man ought. Do you understand, Vanya? I'm glad you have come, and so I want to say aloud in your presence, so that others may hear, that I'm sick of all this nonsense, all these tears and sighs and misery. What I have torn out of my heart, which bleeds and aches perhaps, will never be back in my heart again. Yes, I have said so, and I'll act on it. I'm speaking of what happened 6 months ago. You understand, Vanya? And I speak of this so openly, so directly, that you may make no mistake about my words,
he added, looking at me with blazing eyes and obviously avoiding his wife's frightened glances.
I repeat, this is nonsense. I won't have it. It simply maddens me that everyone looks upon me as capable of having such a low, weak feeling, as though I were a fool, as though I were the most abject scoundrel. They imagine I am going mad with grief. Nonsense. I have cast away. I have forgotten my old feelings. I have no memory of it. No, 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 and no.
He jumped up from his chair and struck the table so that the cups tinkled. Nikolai Sergeyitch, have you no feeling for Anna Andreevna? Look what you're doing to her, I said, unable to restrain myself and looking at him almost with indignation. But it was only pouring oil on the flames.
No, I haven't,
he shouted, trembling and turning white.
I haven't, for no one feels for me. For in my own house they're all plotting against me in my dishonor, and on the side of my depraved daughter, who deserves my curse and punishment.
Nikolai Sergeyitch, don't curse her. Anything you like, only don't curse our daughter,
screamed Anna Andreevna.
I will curse her,
shouted the old man, twice as loud as before.
Because, insulted and dishonored as I am, I am expected to go to the accursed girl and ask her forgiveness. Yes, yes, that's it. I'm tormented in this way in my own house, day and night, with tears and sighs and stupid hints. They try to soften me. Look, Vanya, look,
he added, with trembling hands, hastily taking papers out of his side pocket.
Here are the notes of our case. It's made out that I'm a thief, that I'm a cheat, that I've robbed my benefactor. I am discredited, disgraced, because of her. There, there, look, look.
And he began pulling out of the side pocket of his coat various papers and throwing them on the table one after another, hunting impatiently amongst them for the one he wanted to show me. But, as luck would have it, the one he sought was not forthcoming. Impatiently, he pulled out of his pocket all he had clutched in his hand, and suddenly something fell heavily on the table with a clink. Anna Andreevna uttered a shriek. It was the lost locket. I could scarcely believe my eyes. The blood rushed to the old man's head and flooded his cheeks. He started. Anna Andreevna stood with clasped hands looking at him imploringly. Her face beamed with joyful hope. The old man's flush, his shame before us. Yes, she was not mistaken. She knew now how her locket had been lost. She saw that he had picked it up, had been delighted at his find, and perhaps, quivering with joy, had jealously hidden it from all eyes. That in solicitude, unseen by all, he had gazed at the face of his adored child with infinite love, had gazed and could not gaze enough. That perhaps, like the poor mother, he had shut himself away from everyone to talk to his precious Natasha, imagining her replies and answering them himself. And at night, with agonizing grief, with suppressed sobs, he had caressed and kissed the dear image, and instead of curses, invoked forgiveness and blessings on her whom he would not see and cursed before others.
My dear, so you love her still?
Cried Anna Andreevna, unable to restrain herself further in the presence of the stern father who had just cursed her Natasha. But no sooner had he heard her exclamation than an insane fury flashed in his eyes. He snatched up the locket, threw it violently on the ground, and began furiously stamping on it.
I curse you, for ever and ever,
he shouted, hoarsely, gasping for breath.
For ever, for ever!
Good God, cried the mother. My Natasha, her little face, trampling on it! Tyrant, cruel, unfeeling, proud man!
Hearing his wife's wail, the frantic old man stopped short, horrified at what he was doing. All at once he snatched up the locket from the floor and rushed towards the door, but he had not taken two steps when he fell on his knees, and dropping his arms on the sofa before him, let his head fall helplessly. He sobbed like a child, like a woman. Sobs wrung his breast as though they would rend it. The threatening old man became, all in a minute, weaker than a child. Oh, now he could not have cursed her. Now he felt no shame before either of us, and in a sudden rush of love, covered with kisses the portrait he had just been trampling underfoot. It seemed as though all his tenderness, all his love for his daughter, so long restrained, burst out now with irresistible force and shattered his whole being.
"Forgive, forgive her!"
Anna Andreevna exclaimed, sobbing, bending over him and embracing him.
"Bring her back to her home, my dear, and at the dread day of judgment, God will reward you for your mercy and humility."
"No, no, not for anything. Never!"
he exclaimed in a husky, choking voice.
"Never, never!"
Chapter 14. It was late, 10 o'clock, when I got to Natasha's. She was living at that time in Fontanka, near the Semyonov Bridge, on the fourth floor, in the dirty block of buildings belonging to the merchant Kolotushkin. When first she left home, she had lived for a time with Alyosha in a very nice flat, small, but pretty and convenient, on the third story of a house in Litany. But the young prince's resources were soon exhausted. He did not become a music teacher, but borrowed money and was soon very heavily in debt. He spent his money on decorating the flat and on making presents to Natasha, who tried to check his extravagance, scolded him, and sometimes even cried about it. Alyosha, with his emotional and impressionable nature, reveled sometimes for a whole week in dreams of how he would make her a present and how she would receive it, making of this a real treat for himself, and rapturously telling me beforehand of his dreams and anticipations. Then he was so downcast at her tears and reproofs that one felt sorry for him, and as time went on, these presents became the occasion of reproaches, bitterness, and quarrels. Moreover, Alyosha spent a great deal of money without telling Natasha, was led away by his companions, and was unfaithful to her. He visited all sorts of Josephines and Minas, though at the same time he loved her dearly. His love for her was a torment to him. He often came to see me depressed and melancholy, declaring that he was not worth Natasha's little finger, that he was coarse and wicked, incapable of understanding her and unworthy of her love. He was, to some extent, right. There was no sort of equality between them. He felt like a child compared with her, and she always looked upon him as a child. He repented with tears of his relations with Josephine, while he besought me not to speak of them to Natasha. And when, timid and trembling after these open confessions, he went back to her with me, insisting on my coming, declaring that he was afraid to look at her after what he had done, and that I was the one person who could help him through, Natasha knew from the first glance at him what was the matter. She was terribly jealous, and I don't know how it was she always forgave him all his lapses. This was how it usually happened. Alyosha would go in with me, timidly address her, and look with timid tenderness into her eyes. She guessed at once that he had been doing wrong, but showed no sign of it, was never the first to begin on the subject. On the contrary, always redoubled her caresses and became tenderer and more lively. And this was not acting or premeditated strategy on her part. No, for her fine nature there was a sort of infinite bliss in forgiving and being merciful. As though, in the very process of forgiving Alyosha, she found a peculiar, subtle charm. It is true that so far it was only the question of Josephine's. Seeing her kind and forgiving, Alyosha could not restrain himself, and at once confessed the whole story without being asked any questions, to relieve his heart and to be the same as before, as she said. When he had received her forgiveness, he grew ecstatic at once, sometimes even cried with joy and emotion, kissed and embraced her. Then at once his spirits rose, and he would begin, with childlike openness, giving her a full account of his adventures with Josephine. He smiled and laughed, blessed Natasha and praised her to the skies, and the evening ended happily and merrily. When all his money was spent, he began selling things. As Natasha insisted upon it, a cheap little flat in Fontanka was found for her. Their things went on being sold. Natasha now even sold her clothes and began looking for work. When Alyosha heard of it, his despair knew no bounds. He cursed himself, cried out that he despised himself, but meantime did nothing to improve the position. By now, this last resource was exhausted. Nothing was left for Natasha but work, and that was very poorly paid. At first, when they lived together, there had been a violent quarrel between Alyosha and his father. Prince Valkovsky's designs at the time to marry his son to Katerina Fyodorovna Filiminov, the countess's stepdaughter, were so far only a project. But the project was a cherished one. He took Alyosha to see the young lady, coaxed him to try and please her, and attempted to persuade him by arguments and severity. But the plan fell through owing to the countess. Then Alyosha's father began to shut his eyes to his son's affair with Natasha, leaving it to time. Knowing Alyosha's fickleness and frivolity, he hoped that the love affair would soon be over. As for the possibility of his marrying Natasha, the prince had till lately ceased to trouble his mind about it. As for the lovers, they put off the question till a formal reconciliation with his father was possible, or vaguely till some change of circumstances. And Natasha was evidently unwilling to discuss the subject. Alyosha told me in secret that his father was in a way rather pleased at the whole business. He was pleased at the humiliation of Ichmenyev. For form's sake he kept up a show of displeasure with his son, decreased his by no means liberal allowance, he was exceedingly stingy with him, and threatened to stop even that. But he soon went away to Poland in pursuit of the countess, who had business there. He was still as actively set on his project of the match. For though Alyosha was, it is true, rather young to be married, the girl was very wealthy, and it was too good a chance to let slip. The prince at last attained his object. The rumor reached us that the match was at last agreed upon. At the time I am describing, the prince had only just returned to Petersburg. He met his son affectionately, but the persistence of Alyosha's connection with Natasha was an unpleasant surprise to him. He began to have doubts, to feel nervous. He sternly and emphatically insisted on his son's breaking it off, but soon hit upon a much more effectual mode of attack, and carried off Alyosha to the countess. Her stepdaughter, though she was scarcely more than a child, was almost a beauty, gay, clever, and sweet, with a heart of rare goodness and a candid, uncorrupted soul. The prince calculated that the lapse of 6 months must have had some effect, that Natasha could no longer have the charm of novelty, and that his son would not now look at his proposed fiancée with the same eyes as he had 6 months before. He was only partly right in his reckoning. Alyosha certainly was attracted. I must add that the father became all at once extraordinarily affectionate to him, though he still refused to give him money. Alyosha felt that his father's greater warmth covered an unchanged, inflexible determination, and he was unhappy, but not so unhappy as he would have been if he had not seen Katerina Fyodorovna every day. I knew that he had not shown himself to Natasha for 5 days. On my way to her from the Ichmenyevs, I guessed uneasily what she wanted to discuss with me. I could see a light in her window a long way off. It had long been arranged between us that she should put a candle in the window if she were in great and urgent need of me, so that if I happened to pass by, and this did happen nearly every evening, I might guess from the light in the window that I was expected and she needed me. Of late, she had often put the candle in the window. Chapter 15. I found Natasha alone. She was slowly walking up and down the room with her hands clasped on her bosom, lost in thought. A samovar stood on the table, almost burnt out. It had been got ready for me long before. With a smile, she held out her hand to me without speaking. Her face was pale and had an expression of suffering. There was a look of martyrdom, tenderness, patience in her smile. Her clear blue eyes seemed to have grown bigger. Her hair looked thicker from the wanness and thinness of her face.
"I began to think you weren't coming,"
she said, giving me her hand.
"I was meaning to send Mavra to inquire. I was afraid you might be ill again."
"No, I'm not ill. I was detained. I'll tell you directly. But what's the matter, Natasha? What's happened?"
"Nothing's happened,"
she answered, surprised.
"Why?"
"Why, you wrote. You wrote yesterday for me to come, and fixed the hour that I might not come before or after, and that's not what you usually do."
"Oh, yes. I was expecting him yesterday."
"Why, hasn't he been here yet?"
"No. I thought if he didn't come, I must talk things over with you,"
she added after a pause. "And this evening, did you expect him?"
"No, this evening he's there."
"What do you think, Natasha? Won't he come back at all?"
"Of course he'll come,"
she answered, looking at me with peculiar earnestness. She did not like the abruptness of my question. We lapsed into silence, walking up and down the room.
"I've been expecting you all this time, Vanya,"
she began again with a smile.
"And do you know what I was doing? I've been walking up and down, reciting poetry. Do you remember the bells, the winter road? My samovar boils on the table of oak. We read it together. The snowstorm is spent. There's a glimmer of light from the millions of dim watching eyes of the night. And then there's the ring of a passionate voice in my ears, in the song of the bell taking part. Oh, when will my loved one return from afar to rest on my suppliant heart? My life is no life. Rosy beams of the dawn are at play on the pane's icy screen. My samovar boils on my table of oak. With the bright crackling fire, the dark corner awoke, and my bed with chintz curtains is seen. How fine that is! How tormenting those verses are, Vanya! And what a vivid, fantastic picture! It's just a canvas with a mere pattern chalked on it. You can embroider what you like. Two sensations, the earliest and the latest. That samovar, that chintz curtain. How homelike it all is! It's like some little cottage in our little town at home. I feel as though I could see that cottage. A new one made of logs, not yet weatherboarded. And then, another picture. Of a sudden, I hear the same voice ringing out with the bell. It's sad accents I trace. Oh, where's my old friend? And I fear he'll come in with eager caress and embrace. What a life I endure, but my tears are in vain. Oh, how dreamy my room! Through the chinks the wind blows, and outside the house but one cherry tree grows. Perhaps that has perished by now, though. Who knows? It's hid by the frost on the pane. The flowers on the curtain have lost their gay tone, and I wander sick. All my kinsfolk I shun. There's no one to scold me or love me, not one, the old woman grumbles alone. I wander sick. That sick is so well put in. There's no one to scold me. That tenderness, what softness in that line, and what agonies of memory, agonies one has caused oneself, and one broods over them. Heavens, how fine it is! How true it is!
She ceased speaking, as though struggling with a rising spasm in her throat.
"Dear Vanya,"
she said a minute later as she paused again, as though she had forgotten what she meant to say, or had spoken without thinking, from a sudden feeling. Meanwhile, we still walked up and down the room. A lamp burned before the icon. Of late, Natasha had become more and more devout, and did not like one to speak of it to her. "Is tomorrow a holiday?" I asked. "Your lamp is lighted."
"No, it's not a holiday. But, Vanya, sit down. You must be tired. Will you have tea? I suppose you've not had it yet."
"Let's sit down, Natasha. I've had tea already."
"Where have you come from?"
"From them." That's how we always referred to her old home.
"From them? How did you get time? Did you go of your own accord? Or did they ask you?"
She besieged me with questions. Her face grew still paler with emotion. I told her in detail of my meeting with her father, my conversation with her mother, and the scene with the locket. I told her in detail, describing every shade of feeling. I never concealed anything from her. She listened eagerly, catching every word I uttered. The tears glittered in her eyes. The scene with the locket affected her deeply.
"Stay, stay, Vanya,"
she said, often interrupting my story.
"Tell me more exactly everything. Everything as exactly as possible. You don't tell me exactly enough."
I repeated it again and again, replying every moment to her continual questions about the details.
"And you really think he was coming to see me?"
"I don't know, Natasha. And in fact, I can't make up my mind. That he grieves for you and loves you is clear. But that he was coming to you is...
"And he kissed the locket,"
she interrupted.
"What did he say when he kissed it?"
"It was incoherent. Nothing but exclamations. He called you by the tenderest names. He called for you."
"Called for me?"
"Yes." She wept quietly.
"Poor things,"
she said.
"And if he knows everything,"
she added after a brief silence,
"it's no wonder. He hears a great deal about Alyosha's father, too."
"Natasha," I said timidly, "let us go to them."
"When?"
she asked, turning pale and almost getting up from her chair. She thought I was urging her to go at once.
"No, Vanya,"
she added, putting her two hands on my shoulders and smiling sadly.
"No, dear, that's what you're always saying, but we'd better not talk about it."
"Will this horrible estrangement never be ended?" I cried mournfully. "Can you be so proud that you won't take the first step? It's for you to do it. You must make the first advance. Perhaps your father's only waiting for that to forgive you. He's your father. He has been injured by you. Respect his pride. It's justifiable. It's natural. You ought to do it. Only try, and he will forgive you unconditionally.
Unconditionally? That's impossible. And don't reproach me, Vanya, for nothing. I'm thinking of it day and night, and I think of it now. There's not been a day, perhaps, since I left them that I haven't thought of it. And how often we have talked about it. You know yourself it's impossible.
Try.
No, my dear, it's impossible. If I were to try, I should only make him more bitter against me. There's no bringing back what's beyond recall. And you know what it is one can never bring back. One can never bring back those happy, childish days I spent with them. If my father forgave me, he would hardly know me now. He loved me as a little girl, a grown-up child. He admired my childish simplicity. He used to pat me on the head just as when I was a child of 7, and used to sit upon his knee and sing him my little childish songs. From my earliest childhood up to the last day he used to come to my bed and bless me for the night. A month before our troubles he brought me some earrings as a secret, but I knew all about it, and was as pleased as a child, imagining how delighted I should be with the present, and was awfully angry with everyone, and with me especially, when he found out that I had known all about him buying the earrings for a long time. 3 days before I went away, he noticed that I was depressed, and he became so depressed himself that it made him ill, and, would you believe it, to divert my mind, he proposed taking tickets for the theatre. Yes, indeed, he thought that would set me right. I tell you, he knew and loved me as a little girl, and refused even to think that I should one day be a woman. It's never entered his head. If I were to go home now, he would not know me. Even if he did forgive me, he'd meet quite a different person now. I'm not the same. I'm not a child now. I have gone through a great deal. Even if he were satisfied with me, he still would sigh for his past happiness, and grieve that I'm not the same as I used to be when he loved me as a child. The past always seems best. It's remembered with anguish. Oh, how good the past was, Vanya!
She cried, carried away by her own words, and interrupting herself with this exclamation which broke painfully from her heart. That's all true that you say, Natasha, I said. So he will have to learn to know and love you afresh. To know you especially. He will love you, of course. Surely you can't think that he's incapable of knowing and understanding you, he with his heart.
Oh, Vanya, don't be unfair. What is there to understand in me? I didn't mean that. You see, there's something else. Father's love is jealous, too. He's hurt that all began and was settled with Alyosha without his knowledge, that he didn't know it and failed to see it. He knows that he did not foresee it, and he puts down the unhappy consequences of our love and my flight to my ungrateful secretiveness. I did not come to him at the beginning. I did not afterwards confess every impulse of my heart to him. On the contrary, I hid it in myself. I concealed it from him, and I assure you, Vanya, this is secretly a worse injury, a worse insult to him than the facts themselves, that I left them and have abandoned myself to my lover. Supposing he did meet me now like a father, warmly and affectionately, yet the seed of discord would remain. The next day, or the day after, there would be disappointments, misunderstandings, reproaches. What's more, he won't forgive without conditions, even if I say, and say it truly from the bottom of my heart, that I understand how I've wounded him and how badly I've behaved to him. And though it will hurt me if he won't understand how much all this happiness with Alyosha has cost me myself, what miseries I have been through, I will stifle my feelings. I will put up with anything. But that won't be enough for him. He will insist on an impossible atonement. He will insist on my cursing my past, cursing Alyosha and repenting of my love for him. He wants what's impossible, to bring back the past and erase the last 6 months from our life. But I won't curse anyone, and I can't repent. It's no one's doing. It just happened, so... No, Vanya, it can't be now. The time has not come.
When will the time come?
I don't know. We shall have to work out our future happiness by suffering, pay for it somehow by fresh miseries. Everything is purified by suffering. Oh, Vanya, how much pain there is in the world.
I was silent and looked at her thoughtfully.
Why do you look at me like that, Alyosha? I mean, Vanya,
she said, smiling at her own mistake. I'm looking at your smile, Natasha. Where did you get it? You used not to smile like that.
Why, what is there in my smile?
The old childish simplicity is still there, it's true. But when you smile, it seems as though your heart were aching dreadfully. You've grown thinner, Natasha, and your hair seems thicker. What dress have you got on? You used to wear that at home, didn't you?
How you love me, Vanya,
she said, looking at me affectionately.
And what about you? What are you doing? How are things going with you?
Just the same, I'm still writing my novel, but it's difficult. I can't get on. The inspiration's dried up. I dare say I could knock it off somehow, and it might turn out interesting. But it's a pity to spoil a good idea. It's a favourite idea of mine, but it must be ready in time for the magazine. I've even thought of throwing up the novel and knocking off a short story, something light and graceful and without a trace of pessimism. Quite without a trace. Everyone ought to be cheerful and happy.
You're such a hard worker, you poor boy. And how about Smith?
But Smith's dead.
And he hasn't haunted you. I tell you seriously, Vanya, you're ill and your nerves are out of order. You're always lost in such dreams. When you told me about taking that room, I noticed it in you. So the room's damp, not nice.
Yes, I had an adventure there this evening. But I'll tell you about it afterwards. She had left off listening and was sitting plunged in deep thought.
I don't know how I could have left them then. I was in a fever,
she added at last, looking at me with an expression that did not seem to expect an answer. If I had spoken to her at that moment, she would not have heard me.
Vanya,
she said in a voice hardly audible,
I asked you to come for a reason.
What is it?
I am parting from him.
You have parted, or you're going to part?
I must put an end to this life. I asked you to come that I might tell you everything, all that has been accumulating, and that I've hidden from you till now.
This was always how she began, confiding to me her secret intentions, and it almost always turned out that I had learnt the whole secret from her long before. Ach, Natasha, I've heard that from you 1,000 times. Of course, it's impossible for you to go on living together. Your relation is such a strange one. You have nothing in common. But will you have the strength?
It's only been an idea before, Vanya, but now I have quite made up my mind. I love him beyond everything, and yet it seems I am his worst enemy. I shall ruin his future. I must set him free. He can't marry me. He hasn't the strength to go against his father. I don't want to bind him either. And so I'm really glad he has fallen in love with the girl they are betrothing him to. It will make the parting easier for him. I ought to do it. It's my duty. If I love him, I ought to sacrifice everything for him. I ought to prove my love for him. It's my duty, isn't it?
But you won't persuade him, you know.
I'm not going to persuade him. I shall be just the same with him if he comes in this minute. But I must find some means to make it easier for him to leave me without a conscience prick. That's what worries me, Vanya. Help me. Can't you advise something?
There is only one way, I said, to leave off loving him altogether and fall in love with someone else. But I doubt whether even that will do it. Surely you know his character. Here he's not been to see you for 5 days. Suppose he had left you altogether. You've only to write that you are leaving him, and he'd run to you at once.
Why do you dislike him, Vanya?
I?
Yes, you. You're his enemy, secret and open. You can't speak of him without vindictiveness. I've noticed 1,000 times that it's your greatest pleasure to humiliate him and blacken him. Yes, blacken him. It's the truth.
And you've told me so 1,000 times already. Enough, Natasha. Let's drop this conversation.
I've been wanting to move into another lodging.
She began again after a silence.
Don't be angry, Vanya.
Why, he'd come to another lodging, and I assure you I'm not angry.
Love, a new, strong love, might hold him back. If he came back to me, it would only be for a moment, don't you think?
I don't know, Natasha. Everything with him is so inconsistent. He wants to marry that girl, and to love you, too. He's somehow able to do all that at once.
If I knew for certain that he loved her, I would make up my mind. Vanya, don't hide anything from me. Do you know something you don't want to tell me?
She looked at me with an uneasy, searching gaze. I know nothing, my dear. I give you my word of honour. I've always been open with you. But I tell you what I do think. Very likely, he's not nearly so much in love with the Countess's stepdaughter as we suppose. It's nothing but attraction.
You think so, Vanya? My God, if I were sure of that! Oh, how I should like to see him at this moment, simply to look at him. I should find out everything from his face. But he doesn't come. He doesn't come.
Surely you don't expect him, Natasha?
No, he's with her. I know. I sent to find out. How I should like to have a look at her, too. Listen, Vanya, I'm talking nonsense, but is it really impossible for me to see her? Is it impossible to meet her anywhere? What do you think?
She waited anxiously to hear what I should say. You might see her, but simply to see her wouldn't amount to much.
It would be enough for me only to see her. I should be able to tell then for myself. Listen, I have become so stupid, you know. I walk up and down, here, always alone, always thinking. Thoughts come rushing like a whirlwind. It's so horrible. One thing I've thought of, Vanya. Couldn't you get to know her? You know the Countess admired your novel. You said so yourself at the time. You sometimes go to Prince R's evenings. She's sometimes there. Manage to be presented to her. Or perhaps Alyosha could introduce you. Then you could tell me all about her.
Natasha, dear, we'll talk of that later. Tell me, do you seriously think you have the strength to face a separation? Look at yourself now. You're not calm.
I shall have,
she answered, hardly audibly.
Anything for him. My whole life for his sake. But you know, Vanya, I can't bear his being with her now, and having forgotten me. He is sitting by her, talking, laughing, as he used to sit here, do you remember? He's looking into her eyes. He always does look at people like that. And it never occurs to him that I am here, with you.
She broke off without finishing, and looked at me in despair.
Why, Natasha, only just now you were saying, let's separate both at once, of our own accord,
she interrupted with flashing eyes.
I will give him my blessing for that. But it's hard, Vanya, that he should forget me first. Ah, Vanya, what agony it is. I don't understand myself. One thinks one thing, but it's different when it comes to doing it. What will become of me?
Hush, hush, Natasha. Calm yourself.
And now it's 5 days. Every hour, every minute. If I sleep, I dream of nothing but him. Nothing but him. I tell you what, Vanya, let's go there. You take me.
Hush, Natasha.
Yes, we will go. I've only been waiting for you. I've been thinking about it for the last 3 days. That was what I meant in my letter to you. You must take me. You mustn't refuse me this. I've been expecting you. For 3 days. There's a party there this evening. He's there. Let us go.
She seemed almost delirious. There was a noise in the passage. Mavra seemed to be wrangling with someone. Stay, Natasha. Who's that? I asked. Listen. She listened with an incredulous smile and suddenly turned fearfully white.
My God. Who's there?
She said, almost inaudibly. She tried to detain me, but I went into the passage to Mavra. Yes, it actually was Alyosha. He was questioning Mavra about something. She refused at first to admit him.
Where have you turned up from?
She asked, with an air of authority.
Well, what have you been up to? All right, then, go in, go in. You won't come it over me with your butter. Go in, I wonder what you've to say for yourself.
I'm not afraid of anyone. I'm going in,
said Alyosha, somewhat disconcerted, however.
Well, go in, then. You're a saucebox.
Well, I'm going in. Ah, you're here, too,
he said, catching sight of me.
How nice it is that you're here. Well, here I am, you see. What had I better do?
Simply go in, I answered. What are you afraid of?
I'm not afraid of anything, I assure you, for upon my word, I'm not to blame. You think I'm to blame? You'll see, I'll explain it directly. Natasha, can I come in?
He cried, with a sort of assumed boldness, standing before the closed door. No one answered.
What's the matter?
He asked uneasily. Nothing. She was in there just now, I answered. Can anything... Alyosha opened the door cautiously and looked timidly about the room. There was no one to be seen. Suddenly, he caught sight of her in the corner, between the cupboard and the window. She stood as though in hiding, more dead than alive. As I recall it now, I can't help smiling. Alyosha went up to her slowly and warily.
Natasha, what is it? How are you, Natasha?
He brought out timidly, looking at her with a sort of dismay.
Oh, it's all right,
she answered in terrible confusion, as though she were in fault.
Will you have some tea?
Natasha, listen.
Alyosha began, utterly overwhelmed.
You're convinced, perhaps, that I'm to blame. But I'm not a bit. You'll see, I'll tell you directly.
What for?
Natasha whispered.
No, you needn't. Come, give me your hand, and it's over. The same as before.
And she came out of the corner. A flush began to come into her cheeks. She looked down as though she were afraid to glance at Alyosha.
Good God!
He cried ecstatically.
If I really were to blame, I shouldn't dare look at her after that. Look,
he exclaimed, turning to me.
She thinks I'm to blame. Everything's against me. All appearances are against me. I haven't been here for 5 days. There are rumors that I'm with my betrothed. And what? She's forgiven me already.
Already, she says.
Give me your hand and it's over. Natasha, my darling, my angel. It's not my fault, and you must know that. Not the least little bit. Quite the contrary.
But you were to be there now. You were invited there now. How is it you're here? What time is it?
10:30. I have been there. but I said I wasn't well and came away. And it's the first time I've been free these 5 days. It's the first time I've been able to tear myself away and come to you, Natasha. That is, I could have come before, but I didn't on purpose. And why, you shall know directly. I'll explain. That's just what I've come for, to explain. Only this time, I'm really not a bit to blame. Not a bit, not a bit.
Natasha raised her head and looked at him. But the eyes that met her were so truthful, his face was so full of joy, sincerity, and good humour, that it was impossible to disbelieve him. I expected that they would cry out and rush into each other's arms, as had often happened before at such reconciliations. But Natasha seemed overcome by her happiness. She let her head sink on her breast and began crying softly. Then Alyosha couldn't restrain himself. He threw himself at her feet. He kissed her hands, her feet. He seemed frantic. I pushed an easy chair towards her. She sank into it. Her legs were giving way beneath her. Part 2, Chapter 1. A minute later, we were all laughing as though we were crazy.
"Let me explain. Let me explain,"
cried Alyosha, his ringing voice rising above our laughter.
"They think it's just as usual, that I've come with some nonsense. I say, I've something most interesting to tell you. But will you ever be quiet?"
He was extremely anxious to tell his story. One could see from his face that he had important news. But the dignified air he assumed in his naive pride at the possession of such news tickled Natasha at once. I could not help laughing, too. And the